ready to keep you company wherever you are. Carte Blanche, the podcast, brings you immersive, hard-hitting stories anytime, anywhere, every week.
Another week, another whole week wrap with Daily Maverick and Carte Blanche. Joining us this week is Daily Maverick journalist Ray Mahlaka. Here's what's coming your way. Decriminalizing illegal mining. Some say that's the solution to our Zama Zama problem. Then, the EFF is on life support. Can it survive the mass exodus?
Look, I'm not happy about warnings of the EFF imploding. I think South Africa needs a healthy opposition party. You know, it's good for democracy, it's good for the electorate if there is a thriving opposition party mechanism in South Africa.
Also, how many ships do you need to make a navy? Just one, it seems. And why doing something good could land you in court. But first, a massive study into South Africa's gender-based violence crisis was published last week. With nearly 20,000 households surveyed, consisting of roughly 50% men and 50% women from all walks of life, it serves as a serious wake-up call to government.
Hi there, Ray. Welcome back to the Whole Week Wrap. It's always lovely having you with us. How are you doing?
Lovely to chat with you, Liz. I'm good. I think I am exhausted. It is that time of the year where year-end fatigue sort of sets in.
No, me too. Now, let's get into today's show. And first, I want to start off with a very serious topic. And this is the GBV survey that was recently done. It is the first South African national gender-based violence study. And the results are really concerning. Some of the results that came from the extensive study showed that about 36% of the women surveyed experienced some form of physical or sexual violence in their lifetime. And just to put that into perspective, that translates to roughly 7.8 million women across South Africa. Now, GBV was especially prevalent in the Black African households, which, I mean, a lot of us have been saying for decades. And then 27% of the women surveyed also said that they had experienced some form of GBV at least since the age of 15 years old. So just such a startling study. It really puts that into perspective.
Indeed. And, you know, Liz, this is such a triggering conversation. We're talking about violence. We're talking about sexual violence, rape as well. But clearly this is a crisis at this point and indicates that law enforcement is really not taking this crisis seriously. We've heard about stories, Liz, when victims often report a GBV incident, they told by the cops to go back to the perpetrator and resolve the issue because this would be considered as a domestic issue. So I wonder if cops are adequately trained to deal with the sensitivity of the issue, because we cannot have a situation where we have such stats becoming more pervasive and serious and there not being any intervention from a law enforcement perspective. So for me, this is quite damning and an indictment on the country and the law enforcement agency's ability to respond to this crisis. I mean, some of the stats were shocking. One that caught my eye is that about 11% of men agreed that if a woman does not physically fight back, then that is not considered as rape. The reason why rape is underreported in South Africa, because reporting a rape incident is traumatizing for the victims. Cops often ask you questions such as, what were you wearing? Mm-hmm. Did you scream? Did you drink alcohol? So it becomes very triggering for the victim. And this is why a lot of victims just don't even bother reporting a rape incident.
You've just raised the point about what this study reveals about men as well. And it really exposes a lot of men's views on gender roles. I remember that they said that about 10.7% of men surveyed said that women should tolerate some level of violence in order to, quote, keep the family together, then you also had roughly 70% of men who felt that women should always obey their husbands. And the most concerning one for me was the 22% of men who felt that women cannot refuse sex. I think it's something that we've raised on this show a number of times, is that we need to also speak and educate our boys and change that social dynamic that's clearly the cause of a lot of the problems that we're seeing.
Indeed, I agree with you, Liz. And for me, that's probably the most difficult challenge to tackle, the attitudes of men and how they view women, because I'm sure these attitudes have been baked in from when men were boys, and sort of grown with these perceptions as they venture from boyhood to manhood. So challenging those perceptions, I think it's going to be very, very difficult. But again, you know, in the absence of successful prosecutions, I think we're going to still have this crisis that will persist, unfortunately.
At a disused mine in Stilfontein, illegal miners have refused to resurface for weeks, fearing arrest and, in some cases, deportation. While it's unclear how many miners are actually in the 2.5-kilometer deep shaft, officials have said between 350 and 400 Zama-Zamas are currently holed up. With the standoff showing no signs of ending, we look at other potential solutions to this very prevalent issue.
Things are looking pretty bad at this stage, you know, with this standoff continuing and authorities saying that even if the miners decided to resurface at this point, many of them will likely not have the energy to do so, because I don't know how many of our listeners are aware, but this is because these are discontinued mine shafts. They have these very rudimentary rope systems and they physically have to climb up these ropes to get out. Now imagine having to climb for 2.5 kilometers and you haven't had water or food for days. So yeah, overall, this seems like a very dire situation.
Indeed, and it's about life or death at this point. And this is why we had a minister who recklessly said, we need to smoke them out. That was very irresponsible and very dangerous of her, I believe, because the state does have a duty to preserve and maintain life, regardless whether you are a documented or undocumented person in South Africa. You know, Liz, this is a very complex one. It cuts across the mining industry. It cuts across people who are jobless. It cuts across immigration, because some of these illegal miners are undocumented. Addressing this issue that has persisted for many, many years, it's not easy. Many have tried, but many have failed. Moving forward, is the solution maybe looking at ways to legalize Zama-Zama operations? If you legalize Zama-Zamas, then is that maybe the right way of controlling their operations? Because I know in some countries, such as Ghana and other countries in the rest of Africa, they are undertaking work to legalize Zama-Zamas and making them an integral part of the mining industry.
I tend to agree with you on the decriminalization aspect of it, because I remember Carte Blanche did a story a couple of years ago on a private mining company that employed these Zama-Zamas, and it ended up being quite a success because suddenly these miners were being incentivized for doing this very dangerous job. So maybe that is the answer. And that is certainly something that a lot of people have brought up, saying that just decriminalize it and just try and incorporate them into the existing legal mining framework. Because clearly this standoff and cutting off food and water and medicines is not the answer, because we've had a similar situation not too long ago in Orkney, where there were also hundreds of miners underground refusing to come up because they were fearing arrest. And yes, they made a number of arrests, I think just over 500 arrests. But to this very day, there are still hundreds in that shaft. So it didn't really solve the problem.
Yeah. I mean, you talked about that incident that Carte Blanche has reported on. But I know for a fact that many mining companies are already investing a lot of money into security measures and community engagement initiatives to combat illegal mining. Maybe mining companies need to offer educational programs, employment opportunities to reduce the economic desperation that drives many foreign nationals into illegal mining. Maybe we need to rethink this crisis because the Amazonas have been around for many, many decades. And maybe our approach in the past has been wrong. And maybe we need to sort of embrace and collaborate with illegal miners and sort of bringing them in to the formal mining industry.
Even if you don't follow politics, you can likely see that the EFF is in a pretty bad state. But is the recent exodus of several party members spelling the end of the Red Berets? Or is this seismic shift just a precursor to a renewed, reinvigorated opposition party?
In recent months and weeks, we've seen a number of big hitters leaving the party and joining Jacob Zuma's MK party in many of those instances. You know, you have Floyd Shivambu, Mzwanele Manyi, you have the former public protector Busisiwe Mkhwebane, and then Dalia Mpofu. So what do you believe led to the downfall of the EFF?
I actually don't know. And the EFF did quite poorly in the May general election. Look, I'm not happy about warnings of the EFF imploding. I think South Africa needs a healthy opposition party. You know, it's good for democracy, it's good for the electorate if there is a thriving opposition party mechanism in South Africa. And if the EFF were to implode, I don't think that's a good thing. It's something not worth celebrating because there are a lot of people who believe in the EFF and people who have voted for the EFF. But Liz, maybe this is normal, having an exodus of people in political parties. I know in the ANC, back in 2007, when Jacob Zuma was elected as the ANC president, a lot of people were unhappy and left the ANC. And this is how the political party COPE was born. A lot of ANC people broke away from the ANC, including Masiwa Lekota and Mbazima Shiloa, who left the ANC to form COPE. Maybe this is a normal part of politics, and maybe this is healthy, Liz. I mean, Malema himself, the founder of the EFF, left the ANC because it disagreed with the direction of the party. Okay. He left the ANC to go form the EFF. So maybe this is something that's normal and healthy.
I agree with you again on this as well, because if you look at it, a lot of the people who are leaving, they've been there since the very, very beginning when the EFF was founded. And I think it makes sense. You know, the country changes and policies change, and then suddenly you find that you don't really fit into this new landscape as well as you used to. And then you move on to something that serves your ideas and your goals better. I also wonder, you know, if Malema has what it takes to reclaim his political strength and win back voters. I'm just wondering if his personality is enough to reel people back in.
Yeah. Look, I know social media and Twitter or X is not an indication of the country's sentiment. But you know, the EFF still gets a lot of following on social media. Mm-hmm. A lot of people still support the EFF and see it as a viable alternative opposition party. So I wonder what Malema's strategy is going to be. Where does he find talent in the political sphere to replace some of those people who've left the EFF?
Last week, City Press revealed that the country's navy only has one partially working vessel, a frigate, that's tasked with patrolling our territorial waters. The rest of the fleet, including several submarines and patrol ships, has been gathering dust awaiting repairs. Repairs government simply cannot pay for.
The SA Navy has certainly seen better days. In fact, we barely have a navy to speak of. According to government, there's simply no money to maintain the fleet. This really doesn't come as any surprise. I know Daily Maverick has done a lot of reporting on this. Carte Blanche has also done this, in which we kind of sound the alarm bells. And we've done this for years to say that our defense force is in tatters. So this is really, unfortunately, not really a surprise.
Yeah, not a surprise at all. So the key question is, what does this all mean? And I think with no Navy resources or adequate Navy resources, It means South Africa could easily be invaded. I wonder how safe are South Africa's coastlines without adequate resources? And we know that there are several active wars and armed conflicts happening in the rest of Africa. To me, I'm all about the how-to and understanding what this crisis means. Are we as vulnerable for South Africa to be invaded? I don't know. I don't want to be alarmist, but I know that if you don't have enough resources, then you are left vulnerable.
Well, it's not only just about global conflicts and actual warfare, but we also use the Navy to guard against illegal fishing, trawlers, and drug trafficking that's really been picking up a lot in recent years. So that's also important. But an interesting thing that someone mentioned while I was kind of discussing this with a few people was that maybe we should limit the size of our Navy, you know, instead of spending millions or billions on all of these really expensive vessels and submarines and carriers and all of that. Should we rather just scale things back to simply having a proper Coast Guard, maybe? And that makes it a bit more affordable and more manageable.
Yeah. Look, I don't know much about the Navy, but I do have a basic understanding of how things work. The extensive Navy system in South Africa is also a result of legacy. So the National Party really went big on expanding South Africa's Navy system. Yes, it was for wrong reasons, because South Africa at the time was an anti-democratic country. But we sit with the burden of legacy. And maybe because South Africa is not a country that engages in wars, should you maybe rethink about limiting our capacity, our Navy capacity? I mean, those are quite key questions as well, too. But I think we find ourselves in this situation because we inherited a system and a legacy that was so large, designed for different purpose back then. Now we're saddled with it.
We're often told to do our bit when it comes to building and strengthening our local communities. From recycling to charity work to helping to fix what is broken, it's all done in good spirit to lighten the load. But this is clearly not the case in some parts of the Karoo, where your good deed might just land you in jail.
We wrap things up with a quirky but frustrating story. Earlier this month, Aberdeen councillor Eldridge Reuters was caught twice repainting faded road markings in town. At the time, Reuters explained that he took it upon himself to paint the road markings since they really hadn't been maintained for several years and practically faded. It's an admirable thing to do and pretty harmless if you think about it, except the Beit Nodir local municipality did not see it that way. Government officials went as far as to say if everyone is allowed to paint road markings, then it could lead to, quote, anarchy, which I found hysterical. Now, it's all a bit ridiculous if you consider that he's really just trying to do his part, and it saves the municipality money and resources, I guess.
It does. And maybe I have a different understanding of anarchy, because my understanding of anarchy, it means lawlessness, toppling a government or undermining the government's function. That's what anarchy means. And I don't understand how anarchy applies here. But anyway, let's just continue for the sake of talking about this bizarre story. My concern, Liz, is that what precedent does this set for a citizen who is trying to do good being arrested? Because I know many neighborhoods in Joburg have taken on government functions. I know many neighborhoods have come together, have opened a bank account, and this bank account, they contribute money every month. And this money is used to fix potholes, for example, that have gone reported to the city but haven't been fixed. And this money is used to fix street lamps that have been reported. So I just wonder, Liz, what precedent does this set? Would we see more arrests of citizens who are trying to do good I really worry about this, Liz. Hey?
Yeah, because in our community as well, you know, in our neighborhood, we also have a handful of people who just take it upon themselves in their own time, no additional costs, take it upon themselves to fix leaks, fixing potholes, cleaning up waste, things like that. And this is entirely voluntary. And it would be such a shame if people like them end up being arrested or being fined because they're just trying to make life a little bit better and a little bit easier for everyone.
Yeah. So basically the city will now have to arrest them for also doing good, because that is the message that this particular case sends out, that if you dare try to intervene and make the city look better and function better, then you are at risk of being arrested and also being labeled as an anarchist.
Yes, which is just wild.
Indeed. I can't reconcile with this, Liz.
No, me neither. Well, that's all we have time for today, Ray. Thank you so much for making the time to chat to us. It's been fantastic chatting to you, and I really hope you have a wonderful week ahead.
Pressing fingers, touch words, Liz.
Thanks for listening. Catch us again next week for another Whole Week Wrap. Until then, why not join the conversation on Twitter, Facebook, and everywhere else? We always love hearing from you.